You are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to episode 29 of the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Pesetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. You can always connect with us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast or swing by the Facebook page, Social Media and Politics Podcast. And remember, if you want to be a real hero, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Or even better, what I've noticed that really works with the iTunes algorithm is if someone new subscribes to the show. So tell a friend, tell a colleague, encourage them to subscribe to the podcast. Because what this podcast is all about and what this episode is all about is the role of citizens mobilizing their networks to take some kind of action. And in particular, we're going to be looking at how citizens participate in the electoral process using digital tools to mobilize support for their favored candidate or cause. Now, this has been a common theme throughout this podcast series and something that was especially prominent in our previous episode where we talked with Samir Patel from Blue State Digital, who was saying that citizen mobilization and the coordination by citizens from below was key for Labour's success in the 2017 British elections. In this episode, we're going to put an academic spin on that concept and talk about what Dr. Joel Penny refers to as the citizen marketer. So Dr. Penny is an associate professor at the School of Communication and Media at Montclair State University, and he's recently published a book called The Citizen Marketer, Promoting Political Opinion in the Social Media Age, that's been published with Oxford University Press. And it looks at how citizens increasingly use logics of viral marketing in promoting their campaign or their cause. So we're going to do a deep dive into that book and talk with Dr. Penny about what he was conceptualizing with the citizen marketer, and then later how he applied that concept to supporters of the Bernie Sanders campaign. And Dr. Penny did a study that's out in the Journal of Communication that looked at different aspects of the Bernie Sanders campaign. So he interviewed the digital director who was running the official arm of the campaign, but then also talked with a number of organizers from volunteer groups who coordinated with the official campaign, and then a completely grassroots Facebook page called the Bernie Sanders Dank Meme Stash. So we're going to get into that, kind of keeping with the theme of our last episode of what the left is doing on social media, but whereas our last episode looked at citizens and labor and the latest UK general elections, we're going to be looking at here citizens and the latest US elections and the Bernie Sanders campaign. So that's coming up in just a second. But first, for the subscribers who've been following the series closely, our next episode is going to be with Utsav Sanduja. He is the chief communications officer for a social media startup called Gab. And Gab is a social network with about 200,000 users that its guiding principle is free speech. So it doesn't censor the content that goes across its platform insofar as it's not pornography or terrorism or something along those lines. But it allows users themselves to censor the content that they want to see by allowing them to mute or block certain words or keywords from showing up in their feeds. And Gab has been controversial in the sense that Apple hasn't approved its iOS app request, for example, because it states that some of the content on the platform is offensive or can be considered hate speech. And also, it's been labeled with a charge of being a congregating space for the alt-right. So we're going to get to the bottom of that. We're going to talk about what this kind of counter-narrative social media site is, what it's all about. But for now, let me introduce Dr. Penny to discuss the role of citizens in election campaigns, the logics underpinning their participation, and the concept of the citizen marketer. My guest today is Dr. Joel Penny, associate professor at School of Communication and Media at Montclair State University. His new book, The Citizen Marketer, Promoting Political Opinion in the Social Media Age, is now out with Oxford University Press. Dr. Penny, thanks so much for taking the time out, and welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first of all, congrats on the book. I just wanted to kind of let the listeners know I haven't read it yet, but I have a copy coming, and I'm looking forward to doing so.
Well, I hope you enjoy it when you get a chance. It's been a long time coming, so I'm very happy to have it out there finally.
Great. And one of the things I'm interested in, especially for this episode, is that this book is all about citizens and their role in the electoral process and activism. Can you start out by giving us an overview to the book in terms of what's it all about and why did you choose to focus on citizens?
Well, in looking at a lot of the research that's out there on social media and politics, there's a tendency, I think, often to focus on kind of the classic model of political communication. It's politicians communicating to the public, to voters. You know, certainly these days with Trump and his tweets, there's a whole new fascination with that, politicians and how they use social media. But I came to this project from the very beginning interested in how everyday people are participating in the circulation of political messages and political ideas. You know, that's a really big part of social media. I mean, that's what makes it so different from earlier kinds of media and communication models that have existed. So politicians like Trump or his predecessors have long had, you know, an opportunity to get on television or get on the radio or get in a newspaper and spread their ideas. But social media with, you know, the kind of latest digital technologies have really augmented and increased the ability of everyday people to participate in this process and kind of be part of the circulation of political communication. And so I thought that was a really important subject to look into, and one that's tricky because, you know, how do you get to this, you know, everyday people? There's millions of people doing this all the time. So I started off very, you know, small scale, looking at just having conversations with people who would post things about politics on Twitter, on Facebook, and really trying to understand why they were doing it, what the significance of it was, and what maybe the consequences would be. So it was always very focused on kind of the grassroots. And that's really been my interest, kind of coming from a background of cultural studies and reception of media and active kind of consumption of media, looking at that kind of the grassroots level of everyday people communicating with each other, which has been, you know, obviously exploding in recent years due to the technology and the capacity for people to have this platform.
Yeah. And what's interesting about it, I think, is you introduce this concept in the book, as the title implies, of the citizen marketer, which you define as when citizens' participation in elections increasingly follows the logics and structures of viral marketing. Can you break that down for us in terms of what's the connection between citizens and these logics of virality or viral marketing?
Well, yeah, this is probably, you know, one of the more kind of controversial claims of the book, and it's really the basis of the whole project. You know, when you look at what people are doing online with politics, you know, hashtag campaigns or sharing viral videos, these kind of techniques are really straight out of the book of what's called viral marketing or word of mouth marketing that has existed in terms of commercial advertising and marketing for a long time, and, you know, for at least for the last, you know, maybe 15, 20 years. Actually, my interest in this kind of activity goes back even before we had something called viral marketing, and this idea of word of mouth endorsement and word of mouth buzz. This has actually been something that is connected of earlier generations of citizens who have tried to make a political statement. So I actually started this whole project really looking at things like people wearing t-shirts with slogans on them out in public. And, you know, this is also a technique that marketers and advertisers have used for a long time. So I kind of started with that connection, really kind of traced it back, really thinking about what this could mean, what the consequences could be, and was really working off this idea of there's a well-established concept in the study of activism and politics. It's called the citizen consumer. The idea that consumption offers another avenue in addition to the kind of traditional way of being a citizen when you vote or you kind of participate in civic organizations, things like this, that, you know, consumption, what you buy, what you refuse to buy or boycott versus, you know, who you support, can be this kind of politics by other means. And these days, when we're in a situation because of the technology and our culture where people have the ability to participate in marketing as well, of kind of selling as well as buying. So, you know, every time that you like something on Facebook, you know, that's considered a word of mouth endorsement. You don't realize you're participating in viral marketing, but you are at an aggregate level, a kind of a structural level, that's what's happening. So Citizen Marketer was a way for me to try to attempt to say that this is another avenue for people to participate in politics by other means. And it's not new. It's gone on for a long time. But again, the technologies have increased so much in recent years that it's become so prominent that it really becomes something that we have to look at. You know, with so much word of mouth endorsement happening all the day online, when people share hashtags for political campaigns or for social movements, that kind of participation is really changing what it means to be an activist, what it means to be a citizen. Participating in politics through viral marketing is kind of the way I'm looking at it, and some, what would be some of the consequences.
That's interesting. So it was that you were originally looking at how citizens make political expressions, and is it that social media is the latest manifestation of that? Is that kind of where you're going with the book?
Yeah, I mean, the way that I kind of started this whole research project, again, I actually didn't start with social media. I kind of backed into the study of digital politics. Originally, this research began with looking at as I said before, t-shirts, slogan t-shirts, or wearing this kind of image or symbol to promote your cause or your candidate. This was happening a lot. You know, I started this back around the 2008 presidential election in the U.S. With President Obama's campaign, the candidate Obama at the time. And there was this kind of explosion of grassroots kind of culture happening where people were, you know, wearing, you know, t-shirts with Obama's face on it. And of course, this is also extended into changing your profile picture to the same image of, you know, Obama's portrait, the very famous, for instance, Shepherd Fairey blue and red one. So immediately I started seeing those connections and really understanding social media as kind of the latest extension or platform that people used to do with things like bumper stickers or buttons or t-shirts, the idea that it's kind of participatory media, for lack of a better term. It's an avenue that anybody, you know, can take with pretty low barriers to entry, is easily accessed, so that, you know, even if you're not a media professional, or if you don't have a printing press or a TV station, you can participate in the circulation of political messages. And again, you know, the social media stuff that we're talking about today, I really try to contextualize that, really talk about that as, again, the sort of more mature form of a kind of grassroots citizen level expression that's been happening really for centuries. If you go back, and I do that in a historical chapter, really look at how this can be traced back even to the 19th century or earlier.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because I mean, I think it's cool that maybe the Obama campaigns is what the project was starting on, and then you went backwards from there and kind of and looked at this word of mouth marketing or expression backwards, right?
Yeah, as I was learning, doing more research into how have citizens participated in the spread of political messages in earlier eras. You know, it turns out there was a whole in the 19th century, everyday people were more important. Probably than maybe even today in terms of spreading messages. So if you go back, I talk in the book about in the 19th century, for instance, a famous campaign. It was William Henry Harrison. So this is in the early, kind of mid 1800s.
Yeah, this brings me back to like old school civics.
Right. So people, parading down the streets with banners and sashes and badges, kind of with their candidate slogans, with the Henry Harrison campaign. It was Tippecanoe and Tyler too. That was the famous slogan. And this was before, let's say, politicians had the ability to use, the broadcast airwaves, for instance, radio and the TV to kind of beam their messages out to, millions of voters. They relied on what Kathleen Hall Jameson calls surrogate message carriers, people who were relaying or circulating the message, carrying it forth into their local communities. And now we've kind of returned to that in a way, after the age of broadcast media, we're back to an age of more grassroots participation than we've seen in a while due to the accessibility of these platforms. And we're kind of witnessing, I think, a return of that kind of model, although these days it's far more tied up in kind of consumer culture and kind of individual expression. And everybody kind of has, instead of just banners down the street, everybody's got their own, interesting memes and symbols that they post on various social media platforms. So it looks a little bit different, but there are some enduring patterns. And it really goes back to this idea that communication and symbols have a lot of power in our politics. In many ways, our political world is practiced through the exchange of symbols. Art and symbols are very powerful. And so it's no wonder that anybody who has an interest in politics wants to get in on that, wants to participate in that kind of symbolic circulation, because there is power there. And that's really a message that I have in the book, that this is not just fun and games or just having fun with politics. It's really about persuasion. It's about influence. And it's about power, ultimately, through, again, this kind of way of framing and symbolizing ideas and people and candidates and parties and movements.
Mm. Yeah, and it's interesting, picking up on the idea of symbols, that on the cover of the book is a citizen putting up a hashtag, a big kind of blown hashtag on the cover. And so I wanted to ask you about, what is the role that communities play in this concept of citizen marketers? Because, I mean, hashtags usually have these, normative or political opinions kind of embedded in them, and the people that use those hashtags or participating in that message. So are citizen marketers useful individually, or is it about that collective action aspect that makes them particularly valuable in, expressing activism or promoting a certain political candidate?
Well, all of these acts are ultimately individual. It's the person making a statement, taking a stand. And social media in general is a very personalized, very individualized kind of expression. That's one of the reasons why people have often criticized it. But of course, it's happening in networks. And what we're really talking about, when you kind of think about things in terms of viral marketing, which again, you know, I can get into some of the controversies around that and why some people makes people uncomfortable. But if you look at that model, it really is about the aggregate power of these individual actions as they happen in networks. So it's, you know, many people using a hashtag, like hashtag Feel the Burn or hashtag Black Lives Matter or Occupy Wall Street. And there is an aggregate kind of effect that happens when people are all using these in conjunction with each other. I think a really helpful distinction is this notion that Bennett and Segerberg give of connective action versus collective action. So we're not really sort of talking about traditional political communities of people kind of always acting in very formalized groups or, you know, people even having to come together in physical space, but they're connecting through digital technologies and kind of coordinating their action. So I would say in terms of, you know, contributing to a campaign, the value is, again, in connecting different people together and having many individuals all kind of participating in the circulation. You know, it's really kind of a social media distribution network for messages that might come from a political campaign or a major group or like a nonprofit group, or it could be something that's totally coming from the grassroots. And that's often, you know, the lines are difficult to draw sometimes, you know, what is exactly grassroots and what is not. But the notion that, you know, people are acting in networks, I think, is really important because these little acts, they might look insignificant. You know, I've kind of faced this in my own work, you know, talking about people posting a profile picture, you know, with a political symbol on it. And you know, if you look at that and you say, well, that's not really doing anything, how is that going to make an impact? Well, you're only looking at it from the, you know, very kind of micro close-up level of the individual. If you kind of pull back a bit and look at what's happening at an aggregate level, if millions of people are doing the same thing at the same time, it adds up to a lot more. And this is, again, you know, why I think we need to take this stuff more seriously and not just kind of dismiss it as so-called slacktivism. When you really understand, you know, for instance, how you know, viral marketers, even political marketers are using this stuff, they are very well aware that this stuff does add up to something a lot bigger than just, you know, little people off on their own little Facebook and Twitter profiles doing things kind of with their friends. Again, it's an aggregate power that happens through network technologies.
Yeah, and picking up on this, as you mentioned, there's a controversy around the viral marketing aspect. And I want to ask you a little bit about that, because one of the things I've noticed from doing this podcast is that a lot of the digital campaigns or campaigns that are, you know, campaigning for a certain activism cause is that they follow these kind of marketing logics, the logics of social media, driving engagement or increasing exposure. So can you talk a little bit about that viral aspect? And could it be the case that citizens who try to achieve this viral trend or snowball effect or getting more diffusion on social media, can that get in the way of the message that they're trying to promote?
Well, I think that it's, you know, I don't want to look at these things as kind of absolutes or kind of essentialize, you know, what viral, you know, marketing means. And there's a lot, often this questions about, you know, is this good for democracy or bad for democracy? It really depends, I think, is the answer. And talking to people, which is, you know, what I do in the book, it's based on a lot of interviews with folks who are participating in these kinds of campaigns of various kinds. And it really is about the meetings that are produced and are sort of circulated. And that's always contingent. That's always based on the context. It doesn't necessarily always work. And a lot of people are wanting to make something go viral for various purposes. Sometimes it doesn't work, sometimes it does. And we're still kind of figuring out, you know, is there a secret sauce? There's a lot of interesting research out there about, you know, what makes content viral, what makes it successful in this kind of environment. And, you know, it really does go back to, I think, essentially, you know, how does it impact people? There's a lot of emotion involved. It's not just about kind of your higher reason, but really this emotional reaction. It's something that is, again, totally dependent on the context. If you have a certain hashtag, you know, the hashtag is kind of the modern equivalent of the slogan that you'd put on a bumper sticker or on a you know, parade banner in a centuries prior. And, you know, whether that is going to work really has to do with what the specific content is and how it evokes certain meanings and how it connects to people and how it impacts how people think and talk about various political ideas. So it's really, you know, not like whether a slogan or a hashtag in itself will work, but what does it actually say? Does it actually get to something that people will respond to and continue to pass around? So when we talk about this as viral marketing, and I, you know, it is controversial for other reasons as well, just the notion of marketing itself kind of ties into certain, you know, concerns about neoliberal logics, for instance. But in general, you know, whether or not this stuff is effective or if it's worthwhile as a form of activism, again, it always goes back to the context and whether it's meaningful in that particular moment. Does the symbol connect to the substance? Which can sometimes be the case in kind of packaged political messages and sometimes not. Sometimes it can be very distorting. And of course, there's a threat here of propaganda, which has been a big concern lately in terms of social media and politics, right? We're talking now a lot about propaganda in ways we haven't before. That's also happening within this as well. So there's a lot of dangers.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the future, we're going to do an episode on this social media network called Gab. Have you heard of it?
I haven't.
It's like a social network that's a hybrid between Twitter and Reddit that is for closed down Twitter accounts. So what Twitter deems as propaganda kind of flows into this Gab space. So that's just a kind of small plug for listeners staying tuned. But I wanted to ask about after the book was published, or maybe while you were still working on the book, you did a really interesting study on the Bernie Sanders campaign and kind of applying this concept of the citizen marketer to that. And before we dive into that, is there any kind of main finding or main point that you want to bring about the book before we get into how that was, you know, tested with the Bernie Sanders campaign?
Well, I think that the main message I'm trying to get across in the book is, first of all, to take this kind of activity more seriously. You know, when somebody's, you know, putting a hashtag out there or changing their profile picture, sharing a viral video, it's not just about having fun, although it often is a lot of fun, and that can be kind of an entry point for people to get people involved. It's not just about looking good. There's this whole concern about, you know, are people virtue signaling? Are they just doing this because they want to look like they care? There are personal and kind of maybe even selfish reasons why people would participate in, you know, the circulation of political messages. But there's also a lot more, you know, there's some serious stuff going on. And when you talk to people, which I did, I spent a lot of time interviewing folks who do this stuff. And many of the, you know, people had a very kind of concrete, very deliberate sense of purpose of what they were doing. They really were trying to influence their peer networks. And that doesn't, you know, sometimes that even could be people trying to convert folks from the other side, which is a lot more difficult and more controversial, ends in a lot of ugliness. But it's often more about kind of rallying people who are kind of on your team, but maybe less inspired, like rallying the like-minded. There's a lot of influence and power here. And so I want, you know, the message, the kind of the takeaway of the book is to consider this stuff as not just expression, but as persuasion, and really kind of focus on the techniques and tactics of persuasion that are happening on a peer-to-peer level, and to also think about the consequences of that, good and bad. And only, I think, if we really sort of recognize this power, do we have the opportunity to use it more responsibly or maybe more effectively, or even try to deal with some of the more negative consequences. One of the things I haven't really talked about yet is I really do see a lot of this stuff as contributing to what we call polarization and kind of hyper-partisanship, kind of dragging people to the extremes and making, you know, it's not just that you're having a political dialogue, but you are taking a stand and, you know, kind of stamping yourself with this, you know, political message that kind of becomes part of your identity. A lot of this has to do with, you know, when you post something online, it's not just you're there as kind of a walking advertisement or you're putting it out there, but you are putting your own identity and your own kind of profile as part of the message and saying, I'm somebody who stands behind this and believes this. So it really does put people in this kind of very strong kind of identification with, you know, a political in-group or political identity that can create a lot of clash. So if we become, again, more aware of how this is kind of affecting our politics, for better or worse, I mean, there's opportunities here to get people more involved in politics, but also in a way that people might not be comfortable with. It's very hyper-partisan often, the kind of stuff we're talking about, and can get very ugly. So I think those kind of questions follow once we are able to recognize the shifts and changes that are happening here. Again, it's not just about political expression as being this kind of thing that happens to everyday people as, you know, their fun and their social life, but it really is a source of political power in our age.
Yeah, and kind of picking up on that idea of polarization, is it that, as you're saying with this kind of a word of mouth marketing, is it that when you decide to align with this candidate or that candidate or this party and that party, is it that you don't want to revert on that because you've already expressed it through symbols that, you know, on social media can be artifacts? If you change your profile picture with, you know, for this candidate or this cause, then it's kind of difficult to retract that and say, no, I actually, you know, I'm switching over. So what is it about that word of mouth marketing or the citizen marketer or social media that is contributing to that polarization, or what's the relationship there?
Well, you know, to get a little more kind of high theory, the kinds of bottles we're talking about, you know, are what I would call, and this is, you know, coming from the author Chantal Mouffe, the agonistic pluralism or agonistic version of democracy, the idea that there's a battle going on between people who are, you know, kind of on different sides. And that contrasts with this notion of deliberative democracy, which a lot of, you know, people who study politics and communication are pretty supportive of. You know, it kind of comes from this idea of the public sphere, work like Jürgen Habermas, talking about, you know, we want people to come together and debate and have dialogue and deliberate and come up with consensus and solutions. You know, that isn't
right for the common good, right?
Right. That's kind of the ideal that a lot of folks hold up about, you know, what would happen when citizens talk about politics. This is a very different kind of model. It's what, you know, we can call the agonistic model or even the antagonistic model. The model is really more like warfare. And that's, you know, a lot of the language that we see now, you know, this kind of like viral warfare or the war of the memes that's happened in the last election. That's really the kind of model that you have. And it kind of connects, you know, back again to models of marketing. I mean, marketers also kind of use, you know, the language and the kind of the ideas of a battlefield or war between different competing products, you know, like the cola wars, for instance.
Right. You can't drink Coke and Pepsi. You're either Coke or Pepsi.
Right. And modern, you know, commercial branding is all about, you know, forming those strong, you know, brand identities and brand relationships. And the same thing is happening in the political space. I mean, if you look at the rancor that was happening even in the Democratic Party in the U.S. between Bernie Sanders and supporters and Hillary supporters, like, which is kind of getting to the paper you're talking about, you know, that was very much a case of people taking sides, really identifying with one or the other and putting it as their profile picture, putting it as their, you know, their message online. And there's some conversation happening, but it's really not dialogue. It's really a kind of what we can call information or meme warfare. And that's really, I think, what we have to understand, you know, for better or for worse, that is the way in which I think a lot of people are participating in this kind of political media is through this kind of the battle of images or the battle of messages that's happening now, not just between, you know, candidates and their campaigns, that's been happening for a long time, but between really everyone who's participating in this, getting online and talking about their favorite candidate, their favorite cause.
Yeah, and that's what I thought was so interesting about this article was that you looked at the Bernie Sanders campaign exclusively, but you looked at different aspects of that campaign as they happened on social media. So you did interviews with the heads of these different pages, basically one being the official digital arm of Bernie Sanders for President. And then there was also a volunteer group that was coordinating with the campaign, and that was the People for Bernie Sanders. And then you had a almost kind of completely grassroots Bernie Sanders dank meme stash, which was an exchange of different memes. And so within these different spaces, you had different types of citizen marketing, or you interviewed the organizers and the moderators of those different aspects. Can you go into what the differences across them were and how citizens were used in each different case?
Yeah, I mean, this was a slightly different kind of research project as opposed to interviewing everyday people. This was actually, I was talking more to the campaigners, the organization folks, people who were running these kinds of various kind of social media, you know, arms and kind of, you know, groups online.
And each one, just sorry to interrupt, yeah, but each one, it wasn't just on Facebook, right? These are for the campaign, for example, they're on all types of platforms. So it's, I think there's a tendency to kind of, also in this podcast, we've been focusing a lot on Facebook and targeting, but there is a broader kind of strategy out there, reaching voters where they are, right?
Yeah, it's totally cross-platform, and it's really better to think of this as an ecosystem. You know, I think a lot of folks studying political social media are starting to move in that direction, kind of moving away from even necessarily a platform-specific focus and thinking more about kind of what happens across all these accounts. I mean, even the Bernie Sanders dank meme stash, that was a Facebook page, but, you know, they were getting a lot of their stuff from Reddit or from other sites, and then people would share it or, you know, take a screenshot, put it on Twitter, put it on anything else they have, Instagram. So it's, you really have to think of this as kind of a totalizing ecosystem. And I would even argue it goes way beyond even the internet, right? I there's still things happening with material culture. Sometimes memes become t-shirts and vice versa, or they become bumper stickers, or sometimes you wear a t-shirt and take a picture of it, it becomes your profile picture, right? So there's connections between the online and offline world as well. So it's not so platform specific, it's an entire ecosystem. Mm. And getting back to your question about the three different sort of organizational kind of structures that they had in the Bernie Sanders campaign, how they were different. You know, each one kind of involved, you know, what I'm calling the citizen marketer participation in different ways. So you had the official campaign that would put out, you know, Bernie Sanders for president, And we put out tweets and also, you know, Instagram posts, Snapchat posts that were very, very on message, always talking about, you know, the main kind of political platforms that Sanders was taking. And they were very much the kind of formal tone. And people would, they created this whole system, which is now becoming pretty familiar in political campaigning, of kind of corralling supporters to share these messages. So they had this thing called Connect with Bernie.
This is the secret sauce, I think. This is the very cool thing that I got from reading the article.
Right. So yeah, Connect with Bernie, I mean, that's just the latest kind of thing. You know, there was a similar thing with the Obama campaign called MyBO, sort of a strange name. But the idea was that it was a kind of a central, and if you think about this as a battle, and I kind of use this metaphor because it really does apply, they're kind of rallying the troops together. You know, it was very specific. They would put out, let's say, a certain viral video. And it would go, it's going to go online on Facebook at, you know, 1:25 p.m. And so they would actually have this tool, this system that would get Bernie Sanders supporters to coordinate, to all show up online at the same time and start sharing, commenting, liking, favoriting, giving what they call engagement metrics. And what it does is it, you know, not only just helps start spreading that video and spreading that message, but it actually gets them over these gauntlets of filtering that systems like Facebook do. So, you know, when you post something on Facebook, your friends may or may not see it. If people don't start liking it immediately, it's going to just sink down in the filtering system and kind of disappear.
Right. And if I could just come in and that saying that this is coming from the official Bernie Sanders campaign, the public page of Bernie Sanders for president. And I was looking in a little bit to the figures of how much organic reach do you actually get as a public page? So I post things for the podcast every now and then for you know, promoting different episodes. But I can see how many people I've reached, and it's a very small subset of my overall group. So I think Facebook's taken these steps to really limit. And when we say limit, we're talking to, you know, less than 5%. You know, it kind of ranges between, we don't know the actual number, but between 3 and 5% of your fan base will see what you post unless you have people sharing it or unless you pay to promote it. And I think that's the interesting part of this Connect with Bernie tool, is that it's basically having citizens share the organic content, increase its reach, and in that sense, doing the marketing for the campaign. And that's kind of the gaming the algorithm, getting more exposure. And I just wanted to highlight that it's such a small number that Facebook actually gives you organically.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So you can kind of think about these folks in this case kind of acting as the foot soldiers, you know, sort of for the campaign's messaging. You know, that's the entire media distribution system that we have these days. It's all about, you know, peer-to-peer sharing and virality of content. So that's happening in the political space as well as in, you know, everywhere else. Like, let's say in commercial advertising, you have the same kinds of techniques being used where they get people to kind of boost the reach and kind of create engagement metrics, as we're saying, you know, likes, shares, et cetera, to kind of push it out there. So the idea is that, you know, this is a certain way of kind of helping a campaign, you know, going back to citizen marketers, this is kind of one version of that. It's a much more kind of top-down, you know, the campaign puts out a message, they rally their supporters to then kind of be the foot soldiers to keep, you know, bring it out into the trenches of the internet, right? Something different was going on in these other kinds of unofficial groups, where the messages were not originating with the campaign, but were coming up kind of from the grassroots, from supporters themselves who were kind of dreaming up, you know, the funniest, best, catchiest Bernie Sanders memes in this case, or hashtags. Let's say, you know, for instance, yeah, Fuel the Burn was one of them.
Right. Which, can I just mention that if our listeners don't know what a dank meme is, Dr. Penny presents us a definition in this paper, which are humorous, amateur-produced, popular culture-oriented graphics in the popular image macro format. So these were the memes that were being shared within these different groups, and also associated with the Feel the Burn hashtag, which is quite an interesting way to increase the reach of those posts. So I just wanted to plug that definition. I thought it was a nice one.
Yeah, so yeah, the dank meme stash was really a totally grassroots group that didn't have any kind of organizational oversight. They were not coordinating with the campaign. I actually talked to the guy who started the dank meme stash. He was at the time, a 19-year-old college student. He had no prior experience in any kind of political campaigning or activism. And he didn't even start the page with the intention to influence the election or get a lot of people participating. It was just at first for fun, and then it kind of turned into something else. Once he reached like 400,000 members of this group, it really turned into one of the kind of unofficial wings or arms of the Bernie Sanders movement, if you want to call it that, not the official campaign. But that was one that had was kind of totally free form. And one of the things I was focusing on in these interviews, I talked to this guy who started the page, and he was really emphasizing that there was really no rules that about what people could post. It was totally open and free form, and it was kind of built that way. It was structured so that, you know, once you hit, you know, I want to join the group, you become a member very quickly. There's no real filtering, and then you just post whatever you want. So it became this, you know, very much like when we think of things like even, you know, Reddit or other kind of, you know, Wild West kind of zones of the internet. It was really a free-for-all in terms of what people were saying. And that was a little bit different from this other group that was really interesting, because I think probably the most innovative thing about it, and one of the reasons to look at the Sanders campaign, obviously it wasn't, didn't win the election, but I do think it's going to be very influential as we move forward. One of the most important things was this group called the People for Bernie Sanders, which was volunteers. They were not officially part of the campaign. They kind of called themselves the official, unofficial wing of the campaign. And what it actually was a group of Occupy Wall Street activists who were using the model of Occupy Wall Street as this kind of, you know, aggregate networked political, you know, social movement, and melding that in a way, or kind of hybridizing that with the more traditional model of the political campaign. So they were in contact with the official Bernie Sanders campaign. They often were coordinating strategies on what hashtags they were going to launch. I learned this from these interviews. And so this was the official, unofficial group, and they had some organizational oversight. What would happen is that they had administrators who would act as curators. So anybody could kind of submit content, but they had, you know, 50 or 60 different kind of administrator folks who were out there to decide, we're going to run with this particular meme or this particular viral video. So, but it wasn't as controlled as the campaign communication, which is very formal, very controlled. It ended up kind of being this interesting midpoint, or kind of a compromise, as I talk about in that paper, between the kind of traditional top-down model of how campaigns operate and this totally unrestricted free-form idea of online communication between citizens. So you kind of had this middle position, and that's actually where things like Feel the Burn came from. So you know, I spoke to Winnie Wong. She was a longtime Occupy activist and one of the founders of the People for Bernie Sanders. She takes personal credit for the hashtag Feel the Burn. And it was really interesting to talk about, you know, when I asked the campaign about Feel the Burn, it was an interesting story. This is what I'm talking about, the people who were on the official campaign side. When they first saw this kind of happening online, they got a little bit worried. They didn't think that this was necessarily a good message for Bernie Sanders, because he was trying to establish himself as a very serious, you know, potential candidate, not just kind of a cause or a little blip on the radar, but somebody that could really compete in the election. And they thought this kind of funny slogan, hashtag Feel the Burn, which I don't know if our listeners know, it's a reference to like 80s workout tapes or exercise videos. Jane Fonda said Feel the Burn in the 80s. So that was the joke. It was a very kind of jokey slogan. And at first they were a little concerned, saying this is not really the message that we want to use. But then they realized that it was serving its purpose. And ultimately what happened, you know, when I was talking to these different folks, there seemed to be kind of a delegation of responsibility, or a multi-layered kind of ecosystem, where the official campaign would do the formal policy-oriented messaging, you know, stuff about income inequality, whereas these other more unofficial groups were kind of given the freedom to do this kind of more pop culture-oriented messaging that the campaign didn't really want to touch. They didn't really want to be associated with that directly, but they understood that this was helping them. You know, all this stuff about, you know, the dank meme stash with all these, you know, it's all about these kind of pop culture fun memes that make, you know, Bernie Sanders look cool or look like a forward-thinking or fun candidate. They actually said, the campaign said, you know, this is actually filling gaps in our own communication, our own marketing. And I was really, you know, surprised, and, you know, actually, maybe it isn't so surprising, but it was really confirmation to hear the guy who was the head of the digital arm of the Sanders campaign say, you know, these memes got us votes. They actually translated into real votes. And so again, it's not just fun and games. This has real power. It does connect with people. And they actually got a lot out of kind of giving room to these groups, sometimes coordinating with them loosely, to kind of go off and do this kind of more pop culture kind of promotion of the candidate.
Yeah, and it's super interesting, because I was listening to, there was an interview with Kenneth Pennington, who is also who you interviewed for the official arm of the campaign, right?
Yeah, Kenneth Pennington. Yeah.
And he was talking on a podcast by The Guardian called Chips with Everything. And he was saying exactly that, that the type of content they would post, he was saying that Bernie Sanders as a candidate is not actually as sort of quote unquote cool as the memes made him out to be. And I've noticed from just looking at some of the Facebook posts of the Sanders campaign, they were a lot of infographics about policy and social inequality, particularly, but that grassroots push of the dank memes and, you know, creating these kind of viral videos, as you're saying, is helping to create an image of this, you know, the cool politician for the younger crowd who the campaign digital director was saying is actually not exactly that type of mold, but that social media push gets young people interested. It gets them mobilized. And I think that's an interesting aspect when you take policy and you put it into memes. Can that engage others who wouldn't be interested in politics otherwise?
Yeah, and I think he was saying in this interview, and I kind of talk more generally in the book, this kind of pop culture, you know, references, you know, saying that your candidate is like a hero from Star Wars or Harry Potter, or your the opposition is the villain, that kind of framing in pop culture language or terms, it really does provide an entry point, particularly for younger people who may, you know, be turned off by or just not responsive to these more kind of complex policy debates, to give them a kind of something to grasp onto, to understand and begin to get involved more with, you know, elections, campaigns, or just politics more generally. So, you know, kind of thinking about the broader implications of this, you know, this is something that I think Democratic theorists might have some, you know, they might like this in some ways, the idea of giving people a way to get involved and bringing kind of more people into the circle of participating in democracy. At the same time, though, it really touches upon some of the big issues that are taking place, because when you are expressing politics through pop culture, it is simplifying, right? It is, if you want to call it dumbing down, it's certainly a way of making something very complex into something very simple, or even, you know, kind of black and white in the sense of heroes and villains, right? You know, I talk about, this is not just in the United States, you know, I talk about in the book, in England, they're doing something very similar, you know, the supporters of Jeremy Corbyn, you know, putting him as, you know, one of the, you know, Skywalkers, and the, you know, the Tories are like a Darth Vader or something, right? So it is this kind of very simplified, and again, going back to this idea of polarization and partisanship, it's a kind of a very black and white way of seeing the political reality, but it is one that's appealing. So we're getting people more involved in a way that is also at the same time has some potential problems or some issues. You know, we talk a lot about in political marketing literature for many years, there's been this conversation about the threat of trivialization and how that might be related to manipulation. And again, you know, again, talking about propaganda, you know, when we sort of package politicians, you know, are we really getting the real substance of what they're going to do politically, or are we just being sold on images that are, in a sense, kind of deceptive, right? And all of that, all those issues of trivialization, manipulation, deception, all of that now is kind of put upon everyone who's participating in the dank meme stash or any other kind of, you know, social media or participation at the grassroots level, because now we're all grappling with these issues, you know, this kind of threat of, again, kind of the packaging of policy and politics into these kind of appealing, shiny surfaces of pop culture and symbols. We're all now on the hook for thinking through those kinds of issues and thinking, you know, does this meme that I'm sending really get to a political, a real policy idea, or does it obscure it? Does it kind of only present an image as opposed to substance? So not to say that it necessarily always will be trivializing, but it's certainly a threat. And that's why I think by becoming more kind of media literate about this idea of the citizen marketer and how we participate, hopefully we can make, you know, wiser decisions about what we choose to put out. And, you know, maybe Feel the Burn, for instance, you know, it's interesting. It's itself has no policy substance to it. It doesn't say anything about what Bernie Sanders would do. And in fact, I think that's why the campaign was initially saying that they were wary of it. But the people for Bernie Sanders folks, this is what, you know, Winnie Wong says in the interview I conducted for this study, that, you know, the hashtag is just a means to an end. It's a way to get people in. People respond to the hashtag, Feel the Burn. It's fun. It's interesting. It's catchy. It's viral. It's sticky, right? All these words that people use these days. And from there, then they can learn more. Then they can, it's again, the entry point into more of a kind of engagement. So we really don't want to see this in isolation. It's just part of, again, an ecosystem that can get people involved, but sometimes in ways that could be controversial.
Yeah, definitely. And following up on that, in the paper, you mentioned this when, you know, the policy gets almost completely divorced from the activities online, which was the group of Bernie bros who, you know, they were a special group. Why don't you tell us more about them and, you know, in terms of the citizen marketing idea? I mean, these guys are, they're all for Bernie. They're maybe highly polarized, but they kind of brought some bad press to the campaign in terms of what happens when you let the campaign distribution flow into the citizen marketers.
Yeah, so you know, if you were following the Democratic primary in the U.S., you know, with you know, Sanders versus Clinton, you know, you may have heard of this sort of controversy around the Bernie Bros. It was a perception, or really, what was a kind of a narrative, this idea that there were some Bernie supporters on social media that were out of control, that they were saying things that were offensive, they were being overly aggressive or combative towards Hillary Clinton supporters, and particularly in ways that were seen as potentially sexist. And you know, that's kind of the, you know, the bros thing. And it was, you know, when I talked to this about the with you know, folks who worked on the Bernie Sanders campaign officially, you know, they readily admitted that this narrative became a problem for them. It was a real negative in terms of their, you know, their strategy, in terms of their trying to frame the candidate. At the same time, though, they really tried to distance. They really tried to say that it was a few isolated people. It really wasn't this large phenomenon as it made it sound to be. You know, I'm not sure exactly. It's kind of hard to say. I don't really have research to say, you know, how many Bernie Bros there really were, or how many people were really acting in ways that could be seen as offensive. But certainly, what happened was is that as they mentioned, the opposition campaign at the time, the Hillary Clinton campaign, was very adept at sort of fashioning this narrative. And this is, you know, again, an interesting, you know, when we think about this as a kind of a social media war going on between supporters, one of the newer techniques is for a campaign to find the most extreme or the most, you know, sort of the worst voices on the other side and then screenshot them, publicize them, magnify them. And that's exactly what the Clinton campaign did. They found sort of the worst of Bernie supporters and really tried to focus a spotlight on them and make that a source of attention. And, you know, talking to the campaign folks on the Bernie Sanders campaign, you know, they were saying, you know, this is kind of inevitable. We have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, you know, maybe more posting, you know, tweets and Instagram posts, and we can't police all of them. You can't control all of that. And there are going to be some bad ones in there. And the, you know, the opposition part campaign can really use this to their advantage if they want to isolate and, again, kind of magnify, you know, for tactical gain, the worst possible voices. So that's where they said they kind of were saying the Clinton campaign was very successful in this and kind of painting the supporters as Bernie bros and then kind of making this narrative and even asking the Bernie Sanders campaign to apologize for their own social media supporters, which they said, you know, they kind of regretted following through on. They sort of just ignored it from their own kind of strategic perspective. But it brought up a really interesting issue, right, which is that when you have all these citizens participating in the campaign marketing, there's less control, there's less kind of hierarchical oversight, and it opens the door to things that could become bad publicity as well as good publicity.
And that's what I think is so interesting about the way that you kind of diced up the Sanders campaign in terms of the groups that were around, is that there were kind of very different norms and activities that were going on from these different social media presences, but also offline presences. So, yeah, how does the campaign control that? But also, you know, with the Connect with Bernie tool, was able to really harness the power of citizens to increase their message. So it's very complex, and I'm very interested in it. What's next? The book is just out. Do you have plans to expand on this concept? Are you working towards something else?
Well, yeah, I'm really interested in this idea of like social media or meme warriors. And, you know, there's been so many news events that happened around the last election and even after that have really kind of put this into focus that we've never even really seen before. So, you know, I don't know if I'm, you know, going to be able to go over to Russia and interview folks, but, you know, we now know that, you know, the Russians are, you know, have thousands of, you know, internet trolls, paid trolls who go around and, you know, try to get a message across, you know, that's obviously pro-Putin, whatever agenda they have. you know, of course, globally, right? Because the internet has no boundaries there. They can get into the politics of, you know, various European countries or anywhere around the world. At the same time, the Clinton campaign was actually admitted to having, I don't know if you want to call them paid trolls, but they actually hired people to go and post on social media. This was around the time of the primary against Sanders. So it's really interesting to see how, you know, I'm talking about citizen marketers in this book as kind of everyday people, but we're seeing almost a kind of a professionalization of this and almost kind of a weaponization of these techniques. And that's also happening very much with the alt-right, so-called, and you know, this has been an interesting report in Data and Society about, you know, kind of the warriors out there who are kind of pushing these very extreme, you know, often racist right-wing messages. And there's a real sense that this is kind of maturing into something that is far more deliberate, far more organized in some ways, or at least kind of coordinated and networked, if not kind of all, you know, kind of taking orders from some sort of top-down command. But that's a really interesting issue that I want to explore some more, is this notion of, again, you know, meme warriors becoming a kind of almost profession or a kind of a front line in these kinds of media battles that are happening between campaigns, between parties, and, you know, various kinds of political factions.
Yeah, because I mean, there's a lot of, you know, people looking at what's going on with the campaigns. What are the media posting? What are citizens reading? Are they looking at the politicians? Are they looking at the media? And I think if a media article gets put on Facebook, if a political post gets put on Facebook, it's up to citizens to share it and make it more or less viral. So I think that the citizens is a super interesting category. I think they're key, and I wish you all the best of luck in future research. Dr. Penny, thanks so much for taking the time out and coming on the Social Media and Politics podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was really fun to talk about it. And yeah, I really love getting into these issues. So thanks for great questions.
I've just been speaking with Dr. Joel Penny, Associate Professor at the School of Communication and Media at Montclair State University. His new book, The Citizen Marketer, Promoting Political Opinion in the Social Media Age, is now out with Oxford University Press. You can follow Dr. Penny on Twitter at Professor Penny. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Social Media and Politics podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show. Signing off from Copenhagen, I'm your host, Michael Becetta. See you next time.